This is a journey into sound. This is a journey into sound. A journey which along the way will bring to you new color, new dimension, new value.
When all is ready, I throw this switch.
I've got a question about the word suicide. But not as it refers to its literal meaning. When I was a little kid, my brother and I would go to a convenience store or a fast food place where you could fill up your own soda. And when you put different types of soda into your glass, that was called a suicide. And I thought that was just something my brother and I said, but I guess it's not. Everybody I know says that. And I was just wondering how that word got attached to doing that.
Jesus Christ!
Listen up. You're going to love this.
When I was in prison, I know I was praying and asking God. And God warned me not to get involved with politics.
If Donald Trump actually does become president, it's going to be attributed to nothing else than a miracle from God. And we'll be able to describe it as nothing else than supernatural intervention.
If Donald Trump is elected president of the United States, it will be a miracle.
One of the things we've done around here, we stick them under coffee tables and end tables. You just stack them up and then put a cloth over them.
Yeah.
Or get a piece of, cardboard or a piece of plywood, mm-hmm. and you make a top, and then you just stack this food. You could have your whole living room with end tables and coffee tables made out of food buckets. Jackson is 50% Mexican.
Yes.
Jim, yeah. It's like...
You're Where's so his fun. Dad? Isn't he cute? A good little Mexican boy here is going to help us introduce to you our brand new 20-year shelf life food.
Oh, inside. He's eating everything.
Oh, he's eating.
Oh, lovely. Yeah. Okay. I can't get it. Look at this.
I'm supposed to be introducing this right here. This is so many different kinds of foods.
Hey,
can you all see that right there? There's an entry. This is 20-year shelf life food. And I put some of that cheese sauce on the taco. It is so
That's called
good.
Queso. Cheese sauce is called queso.
Oh, dear Jesus.
That's awesome. Oh, queso.
I'm a gringo that's trying to tell you about queso. Mexican queso. Food.
Yes.
It's not going to work.
No.
Little Lori,
queso.
Help me. You got some Mexican blood. Five of our kids are full-blooded Mexican kids. So this is Mexican food that real-life Mexicans approve of.
I don't know about you, but there's nothing like queso sauce. I'll tell you that right now. It's
Why
amazing.
Do you endorse Donald Trump? Why are you serving on his advisory committee? What's going on here?
Well, let me tell you some words of wisdom. When you're on God's side, you're always on the right side.
Yeah.
Donald Trump is on God's side.
Amen. That's it, Doctor. Preach it.
Amen.
But and you know what? Donald Trump exudes a strength.
And another great thing that I admire about Donald Trump, he does not lie. He's not a liar. He will tell the truth, even if it's not always to his benefit, which is amazing as a politician. I have never seen that in a politician.
Wow. This would be a great Christmas present for somebody, because put a big bow on it, you know.
Yeah,
in a time of time of emergency,
personally.
This is going to be one
you
of the most sought after items that
paper,
you're going to wish you had.
Yeah,
and everybody who has storage of food, you ought to have.
That's right.
One of our
little porta bucket.
Listen, give me my bucket and let me go be rest in peace and have fun.
This here,
it's the Spread the Word
is
Bible
this
bucket.
This great big huge bucket. Wow. Inside of here is 24 Bibles. 24 Bibles in this bucket.
I think it'd be a fantastic idea, really, to honestly bury a bucket of the Bibles.
274, Trump.
Fox has
President Donald Trump.
Donald Trump is president. Wall Street.
Donald Trump wins presidency.
The prophets were right, people. Against all odds, all the polls were wrong. If you live in the blue, put it back on the screen. If you live in the blue,
right.
I would say, Oh God, help me.
Help California and Arizona.
Oh God.
Oh my God.
Forgive me.
Oh, forgive us.
Because those are the ones who came against the will of God in this election. And God spoke to me that in Los Angeles alone, there's going to be such an earthquake come.
Yes.
That literally the big buildings will be laying on their sides. All of L.A. is going to collapse, downtown L.A. And we're going to have civil war.
That's right.
Much to admire about Donald Trump. There is. Stop that. There's room for the loyal opposition in this country, absolutely. Guess who that is? Kathy Griffin. You gotta love her. That would be the loyal opposition. Omarosa's gonna hurt you.
This is the moment journalist Megyn Kelly was booed and given the middle finger by Kathy Griffin when speaking of high hopes for Donald Trump at a Women in Entertainment event. Undeterred, she went on to say why she made the comment, explaining she thinks the American public needs to do more to understand why Trump went on to win this year's election and is soon to become the President of the United States. She said she has high hopes for the president-elect.
As a people and as women, we must reject the urge to fight with pigs, which gets us dirty and the pigs enjoy. That's actually been one of my number one lessons of the past year. Don't get in the gutter.
Well, the more you try to shave the cat, the more the thing will bite and scratch. It's best, I think, to leave its fur and to listen to Some people like to make life a little tougher than it is. Some people
is a cardboard Donald Trump on fire. Guatemalans took delight in extending their annual pre-Christmas tradition of burning cardboard devils to the US president-elect. For centuries, families, friends and neighbours have participated in the annual ceremony to chase away bad spirits from their homes and neighbourhoods. The cardboard figures come in all shapes and sizes, but this year's star was a devil taking on Trump's likeness in various forms. Holding a fistful of cash, wearing a US sash, and carrying the American flag. One resident explains why Trump was such a popular choice this year. She says, "We're against this person in many respects, regarding deportations, with the wall he wants to build. We do not agree." The celebration originated in the 16th century and took place in various towns, but since the 1990s, it has become popular in the entire country. The Burning of the Devil festivities kick off Christmas celebrations in Guatemala, celebrations perhaps Trump would rather not be part of. Time magazine's Person of the Year, Donald Trump. The publication has released behind-the-scenes footage of their photo shoot and interview with the US president-elect. The magazine cited the upheaval in American politics brought by the election campaign and eventual victory for Trump as the reason behind choosing the New York businessman. Time interviewed the president-elect in his opulent penthouse in Manhattan and took photographs with him and his top advisors. Trump seemed grateful for the honor.
Well, it's a very humbling experience, I can tell you, as somebody that loves this country. It's a very large country, but it's also a even more powerful country than the numbers, because if you look at China and India, and you have others with more people, but when you look at what we do in this country, it's the most incredible place on earth, most incredible place ever. And we were losing that. And I don't want to lose that. And the people that voted for me, we call them the forgotten men and women. These are great people. These are people that built this country, and they've been forgotten.
It's hard to measure the scale of his disruption, Time said in its announcement. Noting Trump's eclectic career as a real estate tycoon and reality television star before winning the highest office in the land. It said, for those who believe this is all for the better, Trump's victory represents a long overdue rebuke to an entrenched and arrogant governing class. The magazine said its shortlist included Trump's rival in the 2016 presidential race, Democrat Hillary Clinton, as well as Turkish leader Tayyip Erdogan and singer Beyoncé.
So stealthy, so secretive. Everyone loves your haircut, but no one knows who your barber is.
A man armed with an assault rifle burst into a Washington, D.C. pizzeria yesterday. Police say he claimed he was there to self-investigate an outrageous and completely false online conspiracy theory. An imagined pedophilia ring supposedly being run out of the pizzeria that somehow involved Democrats, including Hillary Clinton. Well, the suspect identified as 28-year-old Edgar Madison Welch. It is a clear case of real-life consequences of fake news. Let's discuss now. Brian Stelter's here. He is CNN's senior media correspondent. CNN political commentators Peter Beinart and Kayleigh McEnany join us, as well as Mark Lamont Hill. Good evening to all of you. Brian, you first. You have been talking a lot about fake news during this election. This is a prime example of what can happen when people latch onto these conspiracy theories. Is there a way, do you think, to keep this fake news from circulating and and inspiring these extremist views?
This is the question I dread.
Not always extremist.
This is the hard question. This is the question that doesn't have a satisfying answer right now. There are lots of things individuals can do. There are some things Facebook and Twitter and Google can do. Some things that newsrooms can do. You know, Don, I didn't take Pizzagate seriously when it started to come out in early November because I thought it was so ludicrous, so disgusting. People trying to link Clinton, these Clinton haters trying to link her to a pedophilia ring. I just dismissed it. Well, maybe I shouldn't have. You know, maybe we should have taken it more seriously, tried to debunk it more clearly early on. Thankfully, the Washington Post, BuzzFeed, others did do that, did good work on that in November. But, you know, there are steps we can take, but there's no satisfying answers to this very systemic problem.
But that's hard because then you give life to it. Then you give credence
exactly.
to it when you
exactly.
report it legitimately. But the interesting thing, I said extremist views. During the campaign, there were some very rational people who I thought before, and they started believing these things that were, Mark, I mean, don't you agree? And I was like, you can't possibly believe that, and they did.
Right. The amazing thing is how committed people can be to holding on to a position despite all evidence to the contrary. If you have a belief in something or if you want to believe something to be true, you can debunk the story, you can challenge the story, you can give as much life to the story as you want. There will be people who will still tweet the story, believe the story, share the story, and argue the story down. That's what's so scary. This moment, this Trump moment, is kind of a post-fact moment. We don't care what the facts are. We want to believe what we want to believe regardless of what the facts say, and that's very, very dangerous.
What we're seeing right now is a coordinated effort to basically take everything that the government does not want people sharing online and slap labels on it of hate speech, cyberbullying, fake news, and now Russian propaganda. I'm just going to mix that all together in a giant ball and justify censoring it. And you can see when you take a step back and really look at what's going on how coordinated this effort really is. But before I get into all of that in detail, I just want to point out really quick, because I've brought this up before, and some people have asked me to expand on this. Yes, U.S. government propaganda use against the American citizenry is officially legal, and that doesn't mean they weren't doing it before. And how that works is, back in the day, after World War II, we had the Smith-Mundt Act, which was more officially known as the U.S. Information and Educational Exchange Act of 1948. While they were shifting from wartime propaganda policies over to peacetime propaganda policies, they put this thing together, and one of the first things they did was specifically prohibit domestic propaganda dissemination. And the assurance was that Congress, academia, and the mainstream media were going to filter out the government's foreign propaganda before it made its way back to American soil. And as you can see, that's worked super well in the last 70 years. Especially if you recall the fact that back in the 70s, it came out on record that the CIA had planted their own journalists in the print and television media here in the U.S., specifically to bring the foreign propaganda home and disseminate it. That's what they got caught doing. But fast forward to the signing of the National Defense Authorization Act of 2013, in which they specifically amended the Smith-Mundt Act to allow American pro-government propaganda materials produced by the State Department and the Broadcasting Board of Governors to be released inside the United States. So that's it. The gloves have been off since 2013. If you've been wondering why it seems like we're tumbling down this crazy, insane rabbit hole matrix since then with the kinds of things that have happened in our media, now you know why. Because there's just no restrictions at all on this, of course, in the interest of national security. Fast forward now to the last couple of weeks, and it's just gotten really insane, a total Orwellian clampdown. You may or may not have even heard that this happened, but on November 22nd, the House introduced a bill that specifically had a section in there about Russian propaganda, which was passed on November 30. So they introduced the bill, and 8 days later, they're already passing it. This is H.R. 6393, the Intelligence Authorization Act for Fiscal Year 2017. In it, there's Title V, Matters Relating to Foreign Countries, Section 501, which calls for the U.S. government to, quote, counter active measures by Russia to exert covert influence. And then they have a list of media manipulation, and they specifically mention disinformation and forgeries. So that's another way of saying fake news. And as activist Post pointed out, it's easy to see how this law, if passed by the Senate and signed by the President, could be used to target, threaten, or eliminate so-called fake news websites. And we've seen this happen really fast. They rolled out the fake news website list, which had all the alternative media on it, which was written by some liberal community college professor. It's not an official list, but it was passed around in the mainstream media as if it was official. Right at the same time that the House was introducing this bill, on November 24th, you had Washington Post put out this article about how experts are saying that the Russian propaganda effort helped spread fake news during the election, and they're referencing this website here called Propaganda or Not, which is a completely anonymous website. It just showed up in August of this year, so it's a brand new anonymous website, and the only place that the Washington Post is referring to when they call these people who have this website experts is by their own About Us description of themselves. I don't even feel like I should have to point out the fact that anyone can make a website and call themselves American citizens with a wide range of backgrounds and expertise, including professional experience in computer science, statistics, public policy, and national security affairs. Anyone can say that about themselves. It doesn't make it true. But these people have put out their own blacklist of Russian propagandist websites, and if you take a look at this list, you'll quickly see all of the alternative medias on there, along with WikiLeaks, DC Leaks, RT. It's just all mixed up together. N5D is on here. I mean, just everybody you can think of that would ever say anything negative about the American government. And then you have the Washington Post, of course, Bilderberg attending Washington Post, pushing that those people are experts, and they talk about how in their article they received the list ahead of publication. So they published this article on the 24th, but they say in here they received the monitoring report, which was provided to the Washington Post in advance of its public release, identifies 200 websites as routine peddlers of Russian propaganda. So that's legitimizing this list, even though nobody knows who's behind this. But for a website that's so-called experts, this is how they figure out who propaganda is. They sent out this tweet on November 19th saying, pretty much anybody hating on Soros is echoing Russian propaganda. It's a good rule of thumb. So according to the so-called experts at PropOrNot, if you hate on Soros and have anything negative to say about him, you're echoing Russian propaganda. That's experts, supposedly. They've also put up a bunch of other tweets that have been taken down where it's pretty clear this is not a group of experts, but more like a group of paid agitators. I mean, they say things like, oh, look at the angry Putinists and fascists, straight up motherfucking fascists, that's what we're up against.
Oh, Ведь мама жила твоя, все хватит ныть. Бабушка за грани черными.
They're also calling for formal investigation by the U.S. government of anyone who has one of these alternative media websites. We strongly suspect some of these individuals have violated the Espionage Act. Espionage is one of the only crimes, by the way, that's not murder, but still punishable by death. They claim they're not doing a McCarthyite wish hunt, while at the same time, that's exactly what they're doing in their own words. And Glenn Greenwald of The Intercept pointed that out, how this is basically the Washington Post promoting a McCarthyite blacklist from a new, hidden, and very shady group. Now, at the same time that you have that going on, all the stuff with Pizzagate has completely exploded. More and more, this is looking like a PSYOP. And that's not to say, people get real angry when you say you think Pizzagate might be a PSYOP. I'm not saying whether or not the stuff people think is happening within that is true or not. So far, it's a lot of circumstantial evidence that looks creepy as hell, okay? In my opinion, creepy as hell. But it's being used by this group of people. I mean, we're talking about the Podestas. We're talking about James Olifantis, who's the owner of Comet Ping Pong Pizza, who was the former lover of David Brock of Media Matters. Okay, this is a nest of political operatives, and they are using this entire Pizzagate thing to whip up this huge narrative about cyberbullies and hate speech and fake news causing real life violence, and therefore you have to have a clampdown on it. First of all, I mean, the thing is over the top. Some of the Instagram posts that this guy, James Olifantis from the pizza place, have put out are not the kind of things that you would send out if you were the owner of a so-called family-friendly restaurant frequented by children where child sleepovers happened. You wouldn't send out these kinds of things. You just wouldn't. Nobody would, and he does. But beyond that, his avatar is literally a statue of Antinous. Antinous is the Greek teen boy lover, underaged boy lover of a Roman emperor. And it has been pointed out before that statues of Antinous remain without a doubt one of the most elevated and ideal monuments to pederastic love of the entire ancient world. So if this guy is a pedophile and he's running a pedophile ring out of his restaurant, he's also posting what is considered to be one of the most elevated monuments to pedophilia in the entire ancient world as his avatar. It's a little obvious. It's a little over the top. It's almost like hitting people over the head with it. It's so much, okay? This guy is now running to mainstream media outlets like the New York Times and Washington City Paper and NPR and Washingtonian, and he's saying things like, white nationalist conspiracy theorists made up of racist, homophobic individuals are loosely tying together theories.
Conspiracy theorists.
Thousands of threats and bizarre, unsubstantiated conspiracy theories about child sex trafficking.
I'm under assault, I'm being terrorized, so he's saying this is terror. It's all these people that are in chat rooms and on anonymous sites where they can hide behind screen names, so it's really unfair because we don't know who they are. And what he's basically doing is calling for not only the censorship of hate speech and cyberbullying, because he's saying he's being targeted. He's also said he's being targeted by thousands of cyberbullies. Basically, what he's calling for is the end of anonymity on the internet in the name of protecting people from violence and hate speech and cyberbullying. This is directly linked to a Soros Obama United Nations plan for everyone to have an internet ID assigned to them so that you will be tracked and traced everywhere you go online. Everything you say, everything you do will all be put together in one virtual file about yourself. I personally think that's probably already going on anyway. It's as if there's a whole narrative here that's been planned for a very long time. Again, the guy comes from a nest of political operatives.
This vast right-wing conspiracy.
And while that's going on, all at the same time, on Sunday, you had a guy walk in to his pizza restaurant with a gun. He said he was armed to save the children, and he was there to self-investigate Pizzagate, so he's throwing out all the key phrases there to let everyone know he's part of the fake news plot to get this guy. Which the guy claims, by the way, is happening because he's a Hillary supporter, but that absolutely makes no sense. I mean, there's lots of people who are Hillary supporters that aren't targeted by thousands of people across the world for running a pedophile ring out of their pizza restaurant. So that just doesn't even make sense. Anyways, but then you have this guy, he walked into the pizza restaurant with an AR-15 and fired off a round into the floor. He walks in there. Oh, and by the way, he's an actor. So he has an IMDb page and everything. So an actor walks in and fires off a round, linking himself to this whole fake news, Pizzagate, cyberbullying, terrorism conspiracy plot. I mean, look at this AP photo of the guy being arrested. I mean, it just looks like a movie, right? It's just, it's rich. It's so rich. On the same day that this is happening, the EU decides to add fake news to its code of conduct online. The code of conduct online is something that all of the major tech companies have signed. So you have Google, which means YouTube, you have Facebook, you have Twitter, Microsoft. All these companies have signed on willingly to suppress or censor hate speech while promoting the EU's counter-narratives. So that's promoting EU propaganda while censoring hate speech, which is very loosely defined, and as you've seen now, is all going to be rolled up into this giant ball of whatever they basically want to censor. And the EU has now said that these companies have 24 hours with which to censor this fake news and hate speech, or else they're going to escalate from non-legislative action to whatever the next, I guess, legislative action against these companies if they don't censor and shut down fake news and hate speech on the web. So this just happened. In the days leading up to it, the New York Times is putting things out about how the spread of fake news is provoking anxiety in Italy, and they're saying now Italy is going to leave the EU the way that the UK did. And so they're tying it all together. While at the same time, you have the State Department now completely refusing to answer questions from RT at their press conferences.
Do you think it is important to give a specific list of hospitals that you're accusing Russia of hitting? Those are grave accusations.
Once again, you're just wrong. I'm not leveling those accusations. Relief agencies that we find credible are leveling those accusations. So why don't you question them about their information and where they're getting it? Why don't you question your own defense ministry?
Which organization?
Journalists, just like the rest of us are, so it's, you know. She's asking pointed questions, but they're not, you know.
From a state-owned, from a state-owned,
but they're not,
from a state-owned outlet.
But they're not.
From a state-owned outlet.
The questions that she's asking are not out of line.
I didn't say the questions were out of line.
Okay.
I didn't say the questions were out of line.
Okay.
But I'm not.
Oh, no, I understand.
I'm sorry, but I'm not going to put Russia Today on the same level with the rest of you who are representing independent media outlets.
Hold on. But
John Kirby, who's a State Department spokesman, straight up said, we're not going to treat RT like other independent media anymore, which, you know, a lot of our mainstream media is clearly not independent. They just toe whatever the establishment line is. That's why the alternative media even exists in the first place. And while that guy's busy taking himself real seriously, another State Department spokesman not even that long ago was caught on tape laughing it up about how their press conferences are an exercise in transparency and democracy.
Good to see you in this exercise and transparency and democracy.
Is that what it is?
Because he knows what a joke it is. Because going back to the beginning of this video, like I said, State Department propaganda is now 100% perfectly legal in the United States. And so what you're seeing right now happen is a concerted effort to shut down free speech on the web. And they're going to roll all of this together, and they're going to say it's fake news, and it's Russian propaganda, and it's hate speech, and it's cyberbullying, and it must be stopped. In a world where they can give you all of their propaganda, and that's fine. So in a world where our communication of what's happening around us is largely digital, they're now going to make it so that what you can share and see online is their propaganda while censoring and shutting down anything that speaks against it. And it's just crazy that we're actually watching all of this happen. It's so far beyond any of the dystopic movies, but this is what's happening. And it's gonna continue happening. So what people need to do is try to figure out where to go instead, because YouTube and Facebook and Twitter, these platforms are gonna be more and more heavily censored to the point that it's gonna be very hard to share information. We just gotta figure out what we're gonna do next. Because I don't think everyone's just quietly gonna take this.
Okay, that didn't happen.
You bet it didn't.
What did you think about the ride?
It was great! And apparently, I've never been on live television before, but apparently sometimes I don't watch the news because I'm a kid, and apparently Grandpa just gives me the remote after we watch the Powerball.
How you doing, man?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm good. How you doing?
I'm good.
You know, I mean, my knee is a little sore from jogging yesterday, which makes me wonder if jogging is bad. Am I doing permanent damage to my knee by running on it? Is cardio in general bad? Does it speed up the aging process? Because I read this article on Facebook that says it does. But it doesn't matter anyway, because I'm going to keep doing it, because I need to stay in shape, I want to look good, I'm not getting any younger, I'm 32, I'm single, I'm lonely, and I want to attract a partner. Or partners, I guess, because I honestly don't know if human beings by nature are monogamous or polyamorous. But whatever. I'm hanging in there. I'm living the dream. Actually, I'm in the process of losing my dreams. I'm avoiding inevitable death one day at a time. I'm collecting memories. I'm feeling nostalgic. I'm looking forward. I'm trying to live in the moment. I'm laughing when I can. I'm simultaneously enjoying and hating my daily routines. I woke up this morning feeling pretty groggy because I had one too many beers last night. I'm trying really hard not to beat myself up over that decision. No regrets. But I am feeling restless and confused sometimes and antsy and freaked out and happy and excited and discouraged with where my life is at, and grateful at the same time. And I'm experiencing my parents getting older, and friends of mine from throughout my life are having babies, which makes me wonder if I want to have babies. And I'm contemplating purpose in life, and life path, and desperately wanting to change the world, but not knowing what to do. I'm asking why things are the way they are. How do we get here? Where are we going? Is the apocalypse imminent? Are we already in the apocalypse? Is it the beginning of a golden age? What is the deal with synchronicity? What happens when we die? Are there ghosts? Oh, blah, blah, blah. I'm chilling. I'm just chilling. Observing a world run by lunatics, where there's never-ending war and never-ending debt, where there's empty houses and homeless people, where obesity and starvation live side by side, where corporations donate money to cancer research when the chemicals in their products are most likely what's causing the cancer, where financial wealth, material gain, and fame are considered success. Frankly, I'm feeling pretty helpless because I'm too busy paying off my student loans and working two jobs to keep a roof over my head and food on my plate and gas in my tank to focus on any tangible solutions that affect anybody but myself. But I'm good.
It's good. Cool.
Any other bright sides to the suicide?
Hi, everyone.
Hi.
My name is Phil, and I'm a spoken word poet. If you're sitting wondering exactly what that might mean, that's okay. A lot of times people ask what I do for a living, and if I say, oh, I'm a poet, they think that's some sort of cute euphemism for filling out job applications. But that's actually not true. I spend a lot of my time working with schools and organizations and communities, performing and teaching spoken word poetry to people of all ages and backgrounds. A lot of that work is through an organization called Project Voice that I co-direct with a wonderful friend and amazing poet, Sarah Kay. So I wanted to start today off with a poem. It's about my grandfather. And today is a special day for me because even though he passed away a few years ago, today is his birthday. And the poem goes like this. My grandfather is not a strong man, but he knows what it means to build. In 1947, after he and my great uncles returned from the Second World War, they opened up an army surplus store. They called it Union War Surplus Store. Their slogan, from a battleship to a hunting knife, we have it or we'll get it. My grandfather was not a strong man, but he kept his word. The place was half store, half encyclopedia, packed all the way to the ceiling with odd objects that somebody somewhere might want. Steel-toe boots, fire-resistant overalls, a Czechoslovakian dental kit from 1947, packed all the way to the basement with people that somebody somewhere else might forget about, but not here. Like Richard, who did not work there, but showed up every Sunday afternoon in his full military uniform. Never bought a goddamn thing. But once brought his little girl, held her hand, said this is what it smelled like when Daddy was a hero. My grandfather was not a strong man, but he kept us safe. We walked together in the park one night, and a jagged man with more tattoo than skin walked up directly to my grandfather, said, "Hey, old man, my pops used to take me to your store as a kid, and you shook my hand once like I was a man." I still remember that. My grandfather's office was upstairs, but he liked to work down on the floor, lent anybody a smile. Everybody called him Cheerful Al. With his big belly, bald head, long gray beard, little kids would see him and go, "Santa Claus." 6 years after Union War Surplus Store opened its doors, my grandfather had a son, my dad. He is not a strong man, but he knows what it means to build. One summer, when he was a teenager, he worked at the store, built a door in the back. It's still there. 40 years after Union War Surplus Store opened its doors, my father had a son. I am not a strong boy, but I'm trying to learn what it means to build. One summer, when I was a teenager, I worked at the store, built this display that went all the way up to the ceiling. The same ceiling where my dad taught me to identify things. Oh, this here? Oh, this is an old American bombshell. You may want to hold it, but be careful not to hurt yourself. Oh, her there? Oh, she is a young American bombshell. You may want to hold her, but be careful not to hurt yourself. Soon after my father built his door, he walked through it, built his own half encyclopedia, made my grandfather very proud. Soon after I built my display, I ran up to my grandfather's office, showed him what I had done. "Very good, Philip, very good." When I asked him what to do next, he handed me an old piece of paper, a beat-up pen. When I asked him what to do with it, he shrugged his shoulders and laughed. And I began to build the only way I know how. Thank you. Thank you. So that's just one example of spoken word poetry. Poetry that's meant to be performed as opposed to read on a piece of paper. Sometimes people ask about the writing process of spoken word poetry, and it's not that different from creating something else. There's drafts and revisions and hopefully a group of people who you trust to give you some feedback. And that's a little bit of what I wanted to talk about today. I want to rewind for a little bit. It's 2006. I've just started college. And I've been doing spoken word poetry for a few years, but only taught a few workshops. And I find out about a volunteer opportunity to teach spoken word poetry in the local prison system. A friend urges me to sign up, so I do. And to be totally honest, at the time, I don't really think about what I'm getting myself into. Don't think about the nuances of being a privileged kid from the suburbs going into a maximum security prison. But some version of it dawns on me, driving over for my first workshop. Holding onto the steering wheel, thinking to myself, who the hell do I think I am? What'll I have to relate? Will they take me seriously? What could I possibly teach these men? When I finally get into the workshop, the inmates come in one by one. There are 16 of them. We shake hands. We go around and introduce ourselves. There's Marcus, who's here because he wants to write a poem to his wife for their anniversary coming up in a few months. There's Graham, who's never tried poetry before, but likes rap and is willing to give it a shot. And then there's Tim. Tim leans back in his chair, but his shoulders are tense. Eyes furled, he looks directly at me and says, my name's Tim, and I'm just here to listen. But I'm curious, how much do they pay you to come in and teach us like this? And I tell him the truth, nothing, it's volunteer. And he nods his head and says, okay. Fast forward, it's 4 weeks into the workshop. Guys bring in work about all sorts of topics. Some write only about prison, the routine, the waiting, the smell of their bunk bed. Some guys never write about prison. They write about their families, about their neighborhoods, the curried goat at the corner store. Some write about their innocence. Some write about their guilt. But anytime someone reads, everyone else is quiet. There's a guy in the workshop named Gabe. Gabe is Italian. His heritage comes up all the time in his work. His roots are important to him. One time, after getting feedback, he looks around and he says, you know, I've never taken advice from a non-Italian before. Turns out you guys are all pretty smart. I see it happen slowly. The walls between us start to crumble. We are not strangers anymore. I see it in week 5, when the guys start to sit next to people they didn't know before the workshop. Or week 7, when they've got so much positive feedback for each other, they've got to write it down because we don't have time to get to all of it. Or week 9, when they start quoting each other's poems. I'm still an outsider, still a naive kid working in a prison with guys more than twice my age. But I appreciate the fact that they share their community with me. Let me be just who I am, even if for only a few hours a week. It's my first experience being in a community of writers, knowing what it's like to have a group of people that want to make you better. I learn what it feels like to tear some soft part of yourself, give it to a group of people to gently mold it, hand it back to you better than they found it. It's in maximum security prison, the last place I'd ever thought, that I learned to let my writing be vulnerable. Fast forward. It's week 11. Not everyone in the workshop has brought in poetry to share. Tim is the most thoughtful source of feedback in the classroom, but hasn't brought in any of his own poetry. I don't know whether to press him on it. In workshops like this, there's all kinds of reasons guys don't bring in work. From learning disabilities to reading and writing issues to fear of ridicule or even violence outside the classroom. But at the end of the workshop on the 11th week, Tim asks if we can walk together. I tell him sure, but I realize as soon as I say that, that the only walk from the workshop to the exit is through the prison yard. Walking through the prison yard together is a significant act. Our friendship in the safety of the classroom is one thing. But in the public view of the prison yard, it's a risk for both of us. For me, there's a danger of looking overly friendly with the inmates, something that the guards don't like and can even shut the workshop down over. For Tim, there's a risk of looking like a suck-up, a reputation that can have very real and damaging consequences in the social structure of the prison. But we are two workshop collaborators, trading ideas, trying to make each other better. So we open the door and begin walking across the prison yard, in step, slowly. And to my surprise, Tim asks me why I haven't brought any of my own poems in yet. Maybe it was because I was inexperienced as a facilitator, or maybe just a little lack of self-confidence, but I didn't think anybody would notice. I tell him that I've been stuck. He tells me that he is too. So we make a pact to each other that the next week we're going to bring in a piece for each other, even if it's short, even if the other person is the only person to see it. I remember the best piece of writing advice I ever got, which was from my 9th grade English teacher named Arlie Parker. And Mr. Parker said that when you sit down to write the first draft, to not be scared, but to imagine a head on your shoulder, the head of someone who thinks you are the greatest writer since Shakespeare, and to imagine what they would say as they're reading your writing. For me, that person is my mom. God bless her, I could draw an ugly stick figure on a dirty napkin, and she would say, "This is the next big thing." And what Mr. Parker was teaching me to do was listen to that voice in my head that says yes to all my crazy ideas, to all our risks. And then Mr. Parker said, when you sit down to revise, to write your second draft, you have to imagine another head on your shoulder, of someone you respect but who can give you critical feedback. For me, it was another English teacher named Mr. Clemson. Mr. Clemson and I had a great relationship, but he was tough on me. And as I read through the piece, I could hear him going, "This part doesn't make any sense. What are you trying to say here? This line is not nearly as funny as you think it is." And with that, Mr. Parker taught me to take risks in my first draft and see which of those risks actually paid off in the second. The following week, at the beginning of the workshop, Tim slid me a piece of paper. I slid him one too. And the next week, he slid me 2 pieces of paper. And the week after that, he shared out loud. And the week after that, so did I. Fast forward. It's the final week of the workshop. Everyone has brought in all the pieces they've worked on over the semester. I see a room full of smiling men, each with a small stack of wrinkled paper in front of them. Tim's stack is a little higher than most. And we go around the room, trading poems, pulling away our breastplates, letting the others peer in. And I realize halfway through the workshop that for most of these poems, it will be the only time they're shared aloud. And I realize also that up to that point, I had only written poems to share, for people to say, "Good job," for YouTube hits, for a room full of applauding hands. They were not writing for recognition. They were writing for the sake of writing, to figure things out for the promise of self-discovery. Tim volunteers to read a poem. It's about paper, about how wonderful it is in a place like prison to have a space where you can see your own thoughts, hold them in your hand. We share poems about all sorts of things. There's a poem about learning how to whistle, a poem about first kisses, a poem about the joys of a good, long, well-timed fart. We share the dusty corners of ourselves, the parts no one asks about, the things that don't show up on a police record or an artist bio. And for that moment, we are 17 men sharing poetry, not defined by our age or our past or the four walls around us. Last year, I traveled thousands of miles sharing poetry, but some of the most talented artists I know rarely leave a prison cell. It's something I do not forget, an unfair reality I carry with me. At the end of the last workshop, Tim asks if we can walk together. I tell him sure. We open the door and walk across the prison yard. Tim asks whether I will remember him. I tell him of course. And he says, "Well, kick some ass out there for us." And I tell him, "I will try." And with that, I wanted to end with one last poem, a poem I started working on when I was working in the prisons. Thank you all for being here. Thank you all for listening. It's been a real, real honor. My mother taught me this trick. If you repeat something over and over again, it loses its meaning. For example, homework, 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 see, nothing. Our lives, she said, are the same way. You watch the sunset too often, it just becomes 6 p.m. You make the same mistake over and over, you'll stop calling it a mistake. If you just wake up, wake up, wake up, wake up, wake up, wake up, one day you'll forget why. Nothing is forever, she said. My parents left each other when I was 7 years old. Before their last argument, they sent me off to the neighbor's house, like some astronaut kicked out of the shuttle. When I came back, there was no gravity in our homes. I imagined it as an accident, that when I left, they whispered to each other, I love you, so many times over that they forgot what it meant. Family, 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 family. My mother taught me this trick. If you repeat something over and over again, it loses its meaning. This became my favorite game. It made the sting of words evaporate. Separation, separation, separation. See? Nothing. Apart, 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 apart. See? Nothing. I'm an injured handyman now. I work with words all day. Shut up. I know the irony. When I was young, I was taught that the trick to dominating language was breaking it down, convincing it that it was worthless. I love you. 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 See? Nothing. Soon after my parents' divorce, I developed a stutter. Fate is a cruel and efficient tutor. There is no escape in stutter. You can feel the meaning of every word drag itself up your throat. Separation. Stutter is a cage made of mirrors. Every, what do you say? Every, just take your time. Every, come on, kid, spit it out, is a glaring reflection of an existence you cannot escape. Every awful moment trips over its own announcement again and again and again until it just hangs there in the center of the room, as if what you had to say had no gravity at all. Mom, Dad, I'm not wasteful with my words anymore. Even now, after hundreds of hours practicing away my stutter, I still feel the claw of meaning in the bottom of my throat. Listen to me. I've heard that even in space, you can hear the scratch of an I love you.
Very powerful stuff. What more do you want?
I think if I met you, I might fall in love, fall in love. 'Cause when I feel your rhythm, you know I get all caught up, all caught up. Makes me feel like I've been here before, though I never felt these familiar things before. Soon I recall I can't ignore. Makes me feel like I've been here before. And no, won't let it fade away. Fade away. I think if I met you, I might fall in love. Fall in love. When I feel your rhythm, you know I get all caught up, all caught up. And oh, your song in sweet harmony, the one thing that stops me from being me. I finally have reached conscious serenity. I can hear you hearing me, and I know what you mean, what you mean, yeah. And I'm calling on the beats we share, I'm knowing where you're not. I'm waiting on my feet, so barely stomping on the spot. where we meet finally, finally. 'Cause I'm thinking if I met you, oh I might fall in love, fall in love. You think if you met me, oh that you might fall in love, fall in love. But if you ask this question of me about love, I might know nothing of.
Now, go find the others.com.
You know, I don't want to sound like a queer or nothing, but I'm really going to miss you guys when the show's over.